Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner and Dresser Industries versus Lee. Justice Dobbs is recused.
May it please the court, Mr. Mike Hatchell will present argument for the petitioner. He is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, this is a products liability case. The product is silica, powder form, and granule form. The industry is Tyler Pipe Industries, which used silica in its manufacturing process. Theory of recovery is a marketing defect. Failure to warn. The case was submitted to a jury over Dresser's objection as the supplier of the product, that it was entitled to a contributory negligence issue, and it was entitled to a sole cause instruction. The jury found liability issues against Dresser and attributed 96% of the fault to Dresser, 4% to a settling co-defendant. The verdict resulted in a judgment of approximately $750,000 for the plaintiff. The issues on appeal concern the denial of both contributory negligence evidence and a contributory negligence question, and the denial of sole cause evidence, sole cause relating primarily to the conduct of the employer of the plaintiff, and the denial of a sole cause instruction. The disposition by the Court of Appeals, I think, frames the issues before this court. The Court of Appeals did not reach the merits of either contention. It said that insofar as contributory negligence was concerned, our requested question, which was basically taken from PJC, was not in substantially correct form because it did not contain a limiting instruction emulating comment E and comment N of section 402A of the restatement regarding failure to the non-necessity of a plaintiff to discover a defect in a product.
Was that even an issue here? The failure of the plaintiff to discover the defect? Was that
right?
Was that part of the? Was that controverted here?
His failure
to protect himself by wearing a mask and other.
Well, I'm speaking of the yes. Here, of course, they're contending that the failure to wear a mask is essentially the byproduct of the failure to discover the defect. That was the basis of the Court of Appeals saying our issue was not in substantially correct form because that limiting instruction, the emulating comment E, was not part of our request. I think I would like to begin. Oh, and insofar as the sole cause matter was concerned, the Court of Appeals held that neither sole cause evidence nor sole cause instruction were permissible under this court's decision in Varela because our sole cause conduct was that of the employer of the plaintiff, who, of course, is immune under common. I think the easiest issue is the contributory negligence issue. Both of our complaints before the court this morning involve three elements: our right to the question or instruction, preservation, and whether or not either was raised by the evidence. Insofar as contributory negligence is concerned, clearly Duncan disposes of our right. Duncan merged a number of doctrines: misuse, assumption of the risk, even mitigation of damages, into a broad contributory negligence submission. The right to the submission is recognized in Duncan and, of course, has subsequently been recognized in both the forum. The real argument that you're going to hear, I think, in response is that contributory negligence simply was not raised. So I will proceed on to the question of whether or not we properly preserved our right to a contributory negligence question. Again, The sole basis is our failure to include a limiting instruction, incorporating comment N, which says that the plaintiff is not required to discover a defect in a product. A matter of which the Chief Justice and Mr. Justice Gonzalez have both discussed admirably in their dissents in King. Our question was taken, as I indicated, primarily from the pattern jury charge. It is a simple, straightforward, contributory negligence question. Whether or not it should have been included in a borrowed form question, it seems to me, has been resolved by Payne, so that we clearly put before the court a basic, simple, contributory negligence question. The issue
under borrowed form submission, as we now have it in Texas, is it your contention that if the battle's going to be in instructions rather than in questions,
right,
that each party has the burden to request that portion of an instruction of the law which they have the burden on, and no more?
Right.
So that if it's a defensive issue or the plaintiff has a defensive issue to your defense,
yes, it's affirmative defense.
Sentences have to be requested by a party, and you can, in essence, merely request half of what the what an accurate statement of the law would be.
Now consider it to be.
I don't want to go on to this particular. This is a general question.
Right.
And we'll talk about the specific in a minute. But as a general question, is it your contention that, under broad form, now when we're talking about how to phrase the instruction, that each party is supposed to look out for its own interest and request that portion of a legal instruction which it needs to carry the burden on? And if a party fails to do that, then the jury is just going to be stuck with an instruction which is not
I'm not sure that's a question I can answer yes or no, because there's so many permutations of that. I certainly don't buy into your half a loaf. Or the standard example that we used all the seminars, fraud, four elements, you leave out one. No, I don't think that's a substantially correct form.
No, I agree with that. I'm just right. Talking about if there's a defense to this that's always available.
Well, Your Honor has put his finger on the key that I'm not personally resolving in my own mind, a defense that's always available.
And I don't want to, I'm not talking about this case.
I understand. I cannot say that in this case, the affirmative defense to the affirmative defense is always available.
Because
it may or may not be raised by the evidence as seen by the Lipsy case, which is cited in the brief. We have, in my opinion, the right to make the argument insofar as this particular affirmative defense to affirmative defense is concerned, that the evidence does not raise it. And therefore, it seems to me that our request ought to be emulate our right to argue, so that if we take the position that the conduct involved is not the mere failure to discover a defect, we are very much on solid ground in requesting a broad form contributory negligence without the limiting instruction, and that if the counsel wishes the limiting instruction, it's his duty to come forward with that tender.
So in a products liability case where the plaintiff requests broad form negligence submission but no limiting instructions instructing the jury on the correct elements of a premises liability case, the plaintiff would have discharged their duty to request a substantially correct issue if they merely request a broad form negligence issue without those instructions on the elements of a premises liability case?
Well, I guess the underlying premise of your question is that the plaintiff's request was denied. He certainly is on solid ground if it's given and the opposing party doesn't object. But I would say no. If we're essentially dealing with a whole theory of liability and part is omitted, I think it is not in substantially correct form. But here, the defense of contributory negligence can be wholly encompassed within proof that does not include failure to discover a defect. And that is our position in this case. As a matter of fact, I think this particular defense is one that's uniquely handled by the admission and exclusion of evidence, so that in many cases, if the trial court has ruled properly in admitting and excluding evidence, the instruction would never be necessary. It's only in rare instances, it seems to me, when the evidence falls in somewhat of a gray area, which Mr. Justice Gonzalez discusses admirably well in King, in which it's just not easy to tell what the trier of fact would decide one way or the other, that I think that the instruction is ever even going to be necessary. So where the proof can make the instruction optional, it seems to me that the limiting instruction does not have to be tendered by the party who is asserting the defense. In other words, an affirmative defense to the affirmative defense does not have to be tendered. It's very much like, I suppose, in summary judgment practice, where we're dealing with statutes of limitations and the discovery rule and fraudulent concealment. I make my case with my affidavits on limitations. The opposing party must come forward with discovery matters for fraudulent concealment. So I'm very comfortable with the proposition that the better practice is to say that in this particular instance, our request was insubstantially correct.
If, Mr. Angeles, the respondents argue that their lawsuit really involved a failure to warn of the problems with the dust of this chemical that was being used, this property that was being used. You're arguing that whatever warning there was, or if there was warning,
there was no warning.
He just failed to. He should have known about wearing a mask, and the mask was provided. And how come comment N doesn't go directly to the defense of the claim of Mr. or of the contributory nature of Lee's conduct? If he's saying you all didn't warn me, it was bad. And then you all say, well, you should have been wearing a mask. How come comment N doesn't fit exactly that consequence?
It may well.
He should have discovered, without the warning, he should have known he should have worn a mask. To me, implies that he should have discovered that smelling the stuff, breathing it in, was the problem. And that seems to me to be the comment N issue.
Well, comment N, of course, was written before, without any knowledge of our unique approach in Duncan. And in fact, comment N is written in response really to assumption of risk notions. And so I think that it clearly speaks to that, and it seems to me that the argument that can be built upon your question then is to take the concept of contributory negligence in Duncan back to assumption of risk, which is a place where we really don't want to go. That seems to me to be a retreat. Now, plaintiff has the perfect right to argue that what we are saying is that he should have discovered the defect in this case. I can give you plenty of evidence, which I intend to do so in a portion of this argument, that can refute that. But yes, it may very well be that the judge in this case would conclude that comment N was raised. The preservation question is, whose burden was that to request? And we simply say it was not ours. I am perfectly willing to argue to this court Chief Justice Phillips' dissent in King. That is that comment N has really served its usefulness in the bygone era, and really ought not to be followed by this court for the reason that, as I've indicated, Duncan is an amalgamation of theories, and it simply doesn't work. In my opinion, anymore. And let's just look at Keene, and I can show you why.
I think you could argue that, but I'm not sure you have time. just to make sure we get to it, I'd like to go to the second whole half of this case, which is the sole negligence portion of the case. And how are you saying, I mean, it seems to me to introduce this evidence, in light of Varela, even interpreted the way you want to, this evidence has to be of a quality that a finder of fact could conclude that it's 100% the fault of Tyler Pipe.
That's exactly correct.
And would you address how your evidence can show that split in light of the standard practice throughout the world in handing silica sand during the time
right
Mr. Lee was working?
And it has to do with the unusual nature not only of silica, and the way it damages the body, but also the way that it was sold by Dresser to Tyler Fife. It was sold to some extent in sacks on which we could have put a warning. We did not put a warning. But those sacks were ripped open and destroyed really before they ever reached an echelon of employee like Mr. Lee. The second way we sold the product was in bulk. And of course, we haven't raised it in this case, but there is a recognized bulk seller exception in product liability law. So the utility and the effectiveness of any warning that we could have given in this case is very much diminished. It's like handing off a ball, so to speak. Any warning that we could have given in conjunction with the sale of the product is only going to go so far as the company purchasing the product wishes to take it.
Seems like now, you could have given a more efficacious warning than Alcoa could have given in all versus Alcoa.
Well, but again, the evidence in this case is as follows. That silica is, to some extent, an insidious product because we could work around silica in this room as long as it was not above a certain threshold level or the particle size were not of microscopic in nature. And it takes years and years of exposure to silica to really develop silicosis. Even with a warning, if you know that it has these dangerous propensities, you still do not know if your employees are exposed to toxic levels of the product unless somebody samples the air. Somebody does engineering in terms of determining what the threshold limit value is and then takes steps either to ventilate the premises and bring the level down or to supply a respirator.
So your argument's not really what was going on in 1960s or 1970s, but you would make that argument today.
Absolutely
would. That a sand company could sell this sand with absolutely no warning, and it's 100% the fault of the person who put the worker in this condition.
Precisely, and we have expert testimony to that effect, that you simply cannot know ever whether or not you're exposed to toxic levels unless somebody is doing the engineering which discloses that and then takes steps in the work environment to implement that. Now, what did Tyler Pike do? They knew that this was a dangerous product in certain levels. The Department of Health had established in 1958, before Mr. Lee ever came on the scene, that there were certain threshold levels that this manufacturing plant had to attain for their employees to safely work around the product. They had no equipment even to monitor the air. They didn't monitor the air. They had a safety director who said he knew everything there was to know about silica, but he didn't order any monitoring of the air, and they didn't radically enforce the use of respirators. Mr. Lee testified he was never told by Tyler Pike that silica was dangerous, that he should wear a mask or a respirator. And Tyler Pike said, if you can believe this, we didn't care. It was not a concern of ours to do any of this. And yet they are the only people in the chain by which this product is induced and the way it causes bodily harm that could have done anything whatsoever. So I think that is it.
Well, before you sit down, if Tyler Pike was in the best position to submit a warning, how would they know that they need to submit a warning at this? Is your answer that they had as much knowledge as anybody else?
And so testified. Their safety director said, I knew everything there was to know about the danger.
Do you believe that your prudence is such that a person that introduces a dangerous product in the stream of commerce is absolved from giving a warning because somewhere down the chain they have as much knowledge as the person introducing the product?
They are not absolved, although, quite frankly, Your Honor, there is the sophisticated purchaser doctrine, which might implement what you're saying if a warning is given. I mean, that is a recognized doctrine. We didn't raise it in this case because we really didn't have giving on it, but no, the answer to your question is not there. I'll absolve the fault. The question, insofar as sole cause is concerned, is strictly limited to causation. And in my opinion, it does not focus at all on fault. Fault is absolutely academic. It is a mirror image, simply, of the concept of producing cause, which clearly, despite the absence of warning, is always submitted in products.
But in a learned intermediary case where a drug manufacturer relies on a physician, perhaps, to warn the patient and does not have a duty to warn the patient directly, we speak in terms of duty, not in terms of causation, I think.
I think you're exactly right, and that's why we're not wondering.
Why should this be analyzed in terms of causation rather than duty?
Well, it should be for the reason that, number one, we provided no warning, so you cannot really get more or less the handing off the ball, so to speak, in terms of the duty aspect. But here, I think you analyze it in terms of causation. By reason of the nature of the product and by reason of the manner in which it can cause harm, it takes that initial ingredient of employer involvement in order to make the product harmful insofar as causing silicosis is concerned, so that it ultimately gets down to a question of causation. It's the last person on the block who can prevent this, and that is a question. Causation, not a fault.
There are many uses of silicon that will not result in silicosis, is what you're saying.
Oh, as the evidence in this case is, yes, that's exactly right. And also that under proper conditions, you can work around it 8 hours a day with absolutely no deleterious effects whatsoever.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. The court is ready to hear arguments and response.
May it please the court, Mr. Blake Bailey and Mr. Andy Pendo will present arguments for the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Andy Kendall from Tyler, Texas, representing the Lee family in this case. I'm going to spend the first half of the respondent's time discussing the contributory negligence issues in the case with police and court, and then Mr. Bailey is going to follow up directly behind me to discuss the Varela and the sole cause issues in the case. I think it's important for the court to recognize in this particular case, as far as the contributory negligence issues are concerned, is that this is basically an evidentiary question. It is the contention and the proof of the respondents in this case that there was no legally sufficient evidence of Mr. Lee's contributory negligence, which would have required the trial judge to submit an issue on contributory negligence. In the petitioner's brief, they have, I believe, outlined five specific areas of testimony that they contend amount to more than a mere scintilla of evidence of Mr. Lee's contributory negligence. We have taken some time in the brief to refute each and every one of those points of evidence, and our contention is basically, Your Honors, that there not only is this evidence that if allowed, would amount to a mere failure to discover or guard against a product defect, it doesn't even rise to that. Mr. Lee had no idea that the dust he was being exposed to was dangerous. No one told him that. Their basic contributory negligence thrust against him is that he was not wearing a mask and he should have known to wear a mask. There is an absolute dearth of proof in the record put on by Dresser through direct testimony or cross-examination that Mr. Lee had any idea of the dust that he was breathing out of Tyler Pipe that had been harmful to him in any manner. And, Your Honors, I do not think that this is an assumption of the risk type of a situation. I know in Justice Phillips' dissent and also in Judge Justices Gonzales, Senate team, there was a discussion about appreciation of the defect. This is not a case, of course, where Mr. Lee knew that the silica that he was breathing could cause silicosis and went ahead and just said, well, I'm not going to wear a mask because it's hot or it's uncomfortable. That would be the classic assumption of the risk situation. But this is not even a contributory negligence situation. That would be that Mr. Lee had some generalized knowledge that breathing dust could be harmful. Any dust. And there's no evidence in this record that Mr. Lee had any knowledge that just breathing dust, like we all breathe, like working people breathe in factory and boundary situations every day, could be harmful.
Why did he wear a respirator?
Well, he wore a respirator on one occasion. He wore a paper nuisance dust mask because it was just like dust, like if you cleaned your house up, dusted your furniture, or just where you had any non-harmful dust, just to keep the dust away from you. But he did not perceive any danger in not wearing the mask and being exposed to the dust. And I think...
Is that necessary for contributory negligence?
I think it's necessary for a person to not act as an ordinary and prudent person.
So if he was told, put this mask on, but he didn't understand why and never knew why, his failure to do it wouldn't be contributory negligence?
Right. If he had no appreciation that there was any danger, not the appreciation that, hey, I'm going to get silicosis if I don't wear this. But if he had appreciation of, well, there's going to be some ill health effect if I don't wear this mask, that was never evidence in the case. He never knew that.
Basically, assuming that workers in these circumstances are no more knowledgeable than I am about these problems, there would never be contributory.
Well, in a failure to warn case like this, Your Honor, this is what's so ironic about this case, is that the reason that Mr. Lee did not wear a mask because he had no warning from Dresser in any manner, warning on sacks, placards, in-service programs, anything, that this dust that he was breathing that you can't even see, it's a 5-micron, you can't see it, had no idea, paper mask wouldn't even stop it, that this dust was killing him, had no idea.
Is there any serious likelihood that he would have read and understood a warning label on the sack of silica dust that was delivered to his employer?
Yes, sir. And if you will look in the record, there was a mention that was brought up in Mr. Lee's direct testimony to the effect that, Mr. Lee, do you have some trouble reading? He had an 8th grade education. He said, yes, I do. Do you have any trouble understanding warnings? Were you able to take your driving test, symbols, warnings, things like of that nature? He said, I had no trouble with that at all. And under the Magro versus Ragsdale case, there's a generalized presumption that a warning will be read and heeded. And I believe it would be Dresser's burden in this case to come up with some evidence that Mr. Lee was illiterate or would not have heeded it for some reason. And that was not done.
Did any of the other employees wear masks?
No, sir. Well, some of them did, some of them didn't. The facts on that are there was a safety rule that was brought up and introduced by Dresser that...
And excluded one.
No, sir. No, sir. It was admitted. It's an Appendix C in the brief. It was admitted at the end of a deposition without objection from the plaintiff.
Counselor, didn't you say that this silicon dust was so fine that the mask wouldn't catch it?
The paper mask, Your Honor. Now, they were respirators that, looked like
so
a gas
mask. Some
wore
paper masks and some wore respirators?
From time to time, yes, sir.
And these were furnished by the employer?
The respirators were... The employees had to pay for their own paper masks.
But was there any rule or regulation about the use of the respirator mask?
There was. That's what I was getting to. On the one safety rule, governed employees that were working in the spray mix room where the silica was mixed with water. There you were supposed to have a respirator on. But in this case, Mr. Lee was not a spray mix room operator, did not work in the spray mix room, and that safety rule was simply not applicable to him, like the safety rule that Mr. Keene violated in the Keene case, where the court found that even that kind of conduct, where he had knowledge in the Keene case, what sets this apart, even if you look at I know Judge
Justice Phillips and you, Judge Gonzalez, felt that this was more than a failure to discover a defect because King violated the safety rule, and he had a generalized knowledge of the danger. Even though he didn't know the CNG was defective, he had a generalized knowledge of the danger that it could fall over on him if he got in the wrong position. And you two justices said that takes it out of the common end. But we don't even get to that point in this case. Mr. Lee had no generalized knowledge that this dust could be hurting him, and he violated no safety rule because the spray mix room safety rule was just simply not applicable to him. This is an absolute classic case of a man that failed to guard against a product defect because he had no knowledge that was given him by the supplier of that part of the essentially dangerous nature and characteristics of this case. And I implore the court not to retreat from the comment and instruction of the case. I believe that the public policy of this state is such that consumers do have a right to expect that their products or users of products that they're safe. And I would ask the court not to retreat from that.
Is this a situation where all the evidence about Mr. Lee's alleged contributory negligence was introduced into evidence and there was simply no charge on it? Or was there
everything that they cited in their brief, yes, sir, except for Mr. Presswood's deposition. And this sort of dovetails into point three. They're saying that that evidence was excluded that related to the contributory negligence issue in Mr. Presswood's deposition. First of all, just as a matter of looking at the record, it was not excluded for that purpose. So if you look at the motion in limine, went to keeping out evidence of workers generally not following warnings and employer fault. And that's the reason that the judge was going to keep out portions of Mr. Presswood's deposition. Had nothing to do with contributory negligence. And trial counsel could have offered the testimony for that reason. He never did so. Now, he offered a deposition in bulk at towards the end of the trial, but if you'll notice in the brief and in the record, we took great pains to point out to the court that we were not objecting to the offer of Mr. Presswood's testimony on any issue but employer fault and workers not heeding warnings. So when they say it was wrongfully excluded, that's just not right, Your Honor. It was not. We did not attempt to exclude it for that reason.
So you let, without objection, most evidence about Mr. Lee's contributory negligence come in?
Yes, sir. As far as exclusion, the only exclusion issue on contributory negligence goes to Mr. Presswood's testimony.
The evidence that was brought in, what would the harm have been in an instruction on contributory negligence? Instruction, would you get asking for and receiving a comment in type of instruction tagged on to that?
The harm, I guess you could put it this way, that it was submitting an issue to the jury that was not raised by the evidence. Now, that would have been the harm, and that's why we objected to it. And that's why the trial judge, I know the court looked in the record, said, I find no evidence of Mr. Lee's contributory negligence.
So you let them put on the proof, and you believe all this taken together just simply did not rise to us more than this.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And I know the court of appeals opinion is provocative in the sense of who's got had the duty to the burden to submit the limiting instruction or not. And I know that's a whole separate issue. But, Your Honors, in this case, in Mr. Arthur Lee's case, it doesn't make a hill of beans difference about whether the issue was standard in substantially correct form or not. Because even if it was, even if they had tendered that limiting instruction, there was no more than a mere scintilla of evidence.
There's been over the past 5 or 10 years quite a few silicosis cases tried around the nation, I think.
Yes, sir.
I did not see in either brief, maybe I just missed citations from other cases about whether or not this type of evidence does rise to the level of some evidence of contributory negligence. Have you found any other law on that?
Your Honor, in briefing the case, we have a jurisdiction. And I have not done that, Your Honor. I felt, or at least we felt, that the prior case law that the court had developed on comment and instruction, Duncan, King, Kiss, and Shamrock, the Herrera case, the Lipsy case, there's a case out of the Fifth Circuit, the Bradshaw. We just felt that this was such a clear-cut case under law that it just did not rise to the level of contributory negligence. And that the trial court was entirely appropriate in not submitting the evidence just because it was not
not raised in this particular case. And as again, to wind up, Your Honor, whether you say this falls under comment in, I think it's a classic case that falls under comment in if we're going to have comment in. And if the court is going to change the law to do away with comment in, it should be done so prospectively, because at the time that we submitted this case, that was the law. We felt that there were facts to justify that, and that's why the court found that there was no evidence to support the issue. And for that reason, there's no error in the court refusing to submit the contributory negligence.
No questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'm Blake Bailey. I'm going to be handling the second portion dealing with Varela and with sole cause. I'd like to ask the court's indulgence for a moment to go through a few of the facts, because I suspect that a lot of the legal issues I agree with the opposing counsel on, and it may be one that we can narrow down our discussions on. First of all, dealing with the point that was just raised on Arthur Lee's negligence, if there was any, Dresser admits that they never provided any type of warnings of any kind that Arthur Lee could have used to know that the dust was dangerous. Incidentally, the dust that actually hurt him was not the dust he saw or that, quote, bothered him. The dust that killed Arthur Lee was 5 microns or smaller in size, or at least smaller than 10 microns. If you take a pluck out a piece of hair from your head and measure the diameter of that hair, that's about 100 microns. So the stuff we're talking about that got through the defense mechanisms and into the lungs, he never saw. The dust that he breathed in that worried him, the body handles fine. We have what are known as macrophages and T cells and B cells that attack this and wash it out. And it works perfectly. That's why workers don't die all over the place, and they're allowed to work in dirty environments. That's what workers do. The reason that a worker who's exposed to silica or asbestos comes out differently is because it destroys that very immune system and causes scarring to continue to occur even after you're out of the environment. That's what happened to Arthur Lee. He was exposed to invisible dust that is different than the dust that a worker should be expected to be exposed to, something outside the range of the ordinary worker's knowledge. Varel versus Fiberboard spends a good deal of time talking about that very point. Dresser gave no warnings. Dresser is indignant over the fact that Tyler Pike provided absolutely no warnings, no safety instructions, no procedures, no policies, no safety meetings, no mask that would have stopped it even if he had worn them. Arthur Lee wore a nuisance dust mask once that he bought from the employer. Now, Dresser ships this silica flour, which is ground very finely, so now we have the size particles we're going to need for years to Tyler Potty. They visited the plant. It's not true that the sacks were torn off before the workers got to them. The workers saw the sacks.
I'll ask you a question about something you said a moment ago, and that is that the microscopic nature of the dust particles that resulted in silicosis would not have been inhibited by the breathing devices, the protective gear that was provided. Is that correct?
The nuisance dust mask that Arthur Lee purchased and wore to avoid just
the paper mask, not the respirator.
Right. He had now even certain respirators won't work, Your Honor. You have to have a Bureau of Mine approved respirator that can handle fumes and microscopic particles before you're going to have
the
any
employees
chance.
Employees were never advised that this was Tyler Pipe advised of this.
No,
were
sir.
They aware of it?
The theory that the defendants had about Tyler Pipe was that since Tyler Pipe had been in business for a long time and that information is available, state-of-the-art knowledge, Tyler Pipe should have had the knowledge as well. They're not arguing that they didn't have the knowledge.
Dresser was aware and didn't fail to warn.
Yes.
The type of respirators that Tyler Pipe made available, would they have been effective against the silicosis?
There's no evidence one way or the other, Your Honor, about the respirators that were worn in the mixing room. There's only one portion of the plant that
they were
was
only required to be worn in the mixing room anyway.
Yes, sir. Right. There's only one portion of the plant that was ever required to wear those, and they didn't wear them
That was not the portion of the plant which...
He worked around that area, but he never worked in that area. The rules that applied to Arthur Lee never required him at any time to wear a respirator, a mask, or any other type of device around his face.
And there's no evidence that would have inhibited the results of the development of silicosis had he worn?
To the contrary, the mass, the paper mass he wore would have had no effect at all on microscopic particles.
As between an employer, you can instruct an employee on proper safety measures, and the manufacturer of this material, who could print a label on a package, which one has the best chance of getting through to Mr. Lee what he needs to do to keep from hurting himself?
No question about the answer. The answer is the employer. No question about it. Let's assume, though, Your Honor, that you and I have a duty to warn this lady over here of a danger. You know her. You see her in the office. I live in Tyler, Texas, but we both have an independent freestanding duty to warn this lady. I don't do it. You don't do it. Now, you may be more responsible. You may be more at fault. But for me to say that because you did not warn this lady of a danger, that this completely obfuscates my responsibility. You are solely at fault. You have interceded the causation between my duty and this lady.
If there is evidence that your warning or your duty to warn would have been almost of no consequence or perhaps of no consequence to the employee, and another warning would have been, isn't that exactly what sole cause is about?
No, Your Honor, it isn't. Because if there's any level of, if I have a responsibility to get a warning ultimately to my user, and under Texas law, it is a presumption that that user is going to read and heed that warning, then there's no way that an independent, now, if you're the employer, Your Honor.
What is the element of causation? You're presuming causation.
Well, that's the presumption in law, Your Honor, in Texas.
So if there is a duty to warn, you presume cause.
In Magro versus Ragsdale, there is a rebuttable presumption that a worker or end user of a product will read that instruction and that warning and heed it. Now, that can be rebutted by illiteracy, by drunkenness, by proof of a lack of judgment on the part of the user. Now, it's very important in this case. I know the other side has suggested that Mr. Lee could only read symbols. That's not true. He went through the eighth grade. He had some trouble reading, but he could read warnings. There was never a submission. There was never even a cross-examination, much less a submission to the jury on the Magro versus Ragsdale exception to the presumption that Arthur Lee would have read and would have heeded the warnings. That's a public policy statement that's been made by this court and has been followed in products liability by all of us for a good while.
If this accident or this injury were caused solely by Tyler Pike as opposed to Dresser, then was Dresser entitled to an issue on that and to adduce its evidence?
Your Honor, in my opinion, if I was on the court, I would suggest that the Varela should be added to, if you will, or explained, to suggest that if there is a complete breaking of causation, i.e. sole cause, or if you could prove all of the elements of sophisticated intermediary, that should absolve the responsibility of the manufacturer. I don't think that's the stated law that we have now, but obviously I'm not going to be in the back room voting with you, but that's what I would vote for. If, for instance, let's say the employer, when receiving the packaging, ripped off my warnings. That's an interception. That's a sole cause. Let's say that he didn't rip off the warnings, but he got all of his employees together and said, I know that there's this warning on the package, but we have researched this and we have determined that it is an unnecessary warning, and we are persuading you that you should not wear a mask for this. It is unnecessary. I can see an argument there, Your Honor, that if that was done, then sole cause would be a legitimate issue that should be presented in the case.
You take a stronger position in your brief, I think, and that is that under Varela, so that's just too bad. If it's solely the employer's fault, that's just a policy decision you make.
Your Honor, I think that in this case, Varela applies very specifically, and I didn't make that argument in my brief, but the point that I was trying to address is the facts of this case. And the facts of this case are that, in my opinion, the employer had an independent freestanding duty, if not legally, morally, even though they're immune, to tell the employees the dangers if they knew about it. We really don't know if the employer knew about the dangers fully or not. It's not that clear in the record. But I feel that they should have that responsibility. But if they have that responsibility, it should have nothing to do with the responsibility of the manufacturer of the product to spend the 12 cents it takes to put the ink on the side of a sack to warning and instruction to the user so that the user can make a free thinking, independent, informed choice. Am I going to work in this employer's environment or not?
Isn't it for the jury to decide whether there's any likelihood at all that an employee in these circumstances is going to study a warning label on material that he is told to carry and do and fix with?
No, sir. I don't think so. And I think there's a good public policy reason behind that. The public policy reason is, and stated by this court, is that there should be a presumption that the users are going to follow the warnings and instructions, and that adds to the duty of the manufacturer to send those out. It should not be the manufacturer's prerogative to sit back and think, well, this is a pretty dangerous product, but you know, I just don't think anybody would follow that warning. The reverse is true. It's the manufacturer's responsibility to be darn sure that the wording and the manner in which they warn that product actually gets to the ultimate user, and that the ultimate user has a warning that they can follow and understand and read.
Your opposing counsel says that that because of the unusual nature of this product, that is the fact that it, many of its applications are safe, that it has no duty to warn in any circumstance. What type of authority do you cite to the contrary, or do you just appeal to our general understanding?
I really appreciated that in the brief, as a matter of fact. I thought it was pretty interesting. Oh, this silica is not dangerous as long as it's in the sack. Well, yeah, a car with defective brakes isn't dangerous while it's still on the showroom floor. There's not any product that's not dangerous until it is used in a foreseeable manner in which it's used. In this particular case, the manufacturer was specifically grinding silica for a specific product where its representatives went out there to observe the process and help set it up, where it is certainly foreseeable that you're going to suspend particles in the air. Foundries are one of the number one industry in the United States for causing silicosis in workers. It is a foreseeable situation that is used because of the manner in which the silica, especially ground silica flour, which is just what this was, that's why it's shipped in sacks, is because it had the consistency of flour. Is a foreseeable use of this that it's going to be suspended in air. It's also foreseeable that you're going to have people like Tyler Pike that aren't going to, incidentally, they did take air samples and sent them to Dressler. We don't know what it said because they never could find them. But it's certainly a foreseeable situation that foundries are going to kill people because they aren't going to keep proper safety methods and they're going to allow them to breathe silica dust, especially silica flour. And it's certainly foreseeable at this plant because Dressler went out there and watched it happen. Never participated in the safety meeting, never gave a brochure, never offered a placard for the workplace, and never spent the time to even put the warning on the side of the sacks that the employees were opening on the floor.
So you're saying that even if Dressler is correct, the sole cause of an employer is properly submitted in all other kinds of cases, that it's never proper in a marketing defect based on a failure to warn because of the presumption
right.
In Magro versus Dragstead?
I think that the sole cause requires two inconsistent theories or stories. The Swearington case that the petitioners referred to, either the employer misused a chain and it broke under the strain because of misuse by the employer, or the defendant moved the truck out from underneath the flatbed causing too much strain on it. One of the two broke it. Both of those stories aren't true. So my point is, Your Honor, that you either have to have a physical interception of the warnings, or you need to have some kind of story that if the jury believes that story, the other one isn't true. That's what sole cause is. What these people are saying isn't that at all. The only information was kept out, and I didn't get to this, but the only thing that was kept out was an objection as to employer fault. That's all we asked to be kept out. That's all that was kept out. It was the experts who were saying, employees don't follow warnings generally, and therefore we think the law should be that the employer should warn and the manufacturer should not warn. They should not have the duty. That's the information that's kept out, Your Honor. All information being on the Tyler Pike came in. All of it did. only the opinion testimony of so-called experts who said employees don't follow warnings generally, which is contrary to Texas law, and we feel, us the experts, that the manufacturer should not have that duty, but the only the employer should. That's the only information that's kept out. And
Counsel,
because,
since you're out of time and just answering a question, I would ask that you think.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Are there any other questions? Let's take Diana Rubin.
No.
Thank you.
And please, the Court, I will attempt to be very brief as the Court's questions have really been quite good. Probably just got you confused now, so it's kind of very time for contemplation. But I am disturbed that opposing counsel, unwittingly, of course, but has carried his argument by misanalysis of the record in this case. On contributory negligence, they position their entire argument on the notion that there is absolutely no evidence that Mr. Lee knew that silica could be harmful. Counsel making that argument was not trial counsel, and I'm certain must have overlooked their own evidence, in which they introduced an admission which reads as follows: it was common knowledge that inhaling foreign substances could cause bodily harm. That's their evidence.
What page is that? Five of
that. That is on page 432, lines 8 through 9.
From what source? What was the source of that?
It's an admission by Dresser that was introduced by Mr. Lee. And Mr. Lee also testified that he would get covered with silica and that it, quote, bothered him. In other words, was causing him physical reaction. And that the reason that the times that he did wear a respirator were because he wanted to see if that would work.
He said it's the stuff you can't see that killed him. I'm
not sure that you can say that that's just established as a matter of law in this record. There's no evidence that the microscopic particles that one breathes are not adhered to that which you can see. I mean, there is evidence that it is the extremely microscopic particles that ultimately will cause the harm. But whether or not they are borne on that which you can see, I think, is inferable from this record. But again, you get back to the notion that here is a man who has knowledge that he's breathing foreign substances and puts on evidence himself that knowledge imparts knowledge of bodily harm. And it seems to me that is at least enough to raise the issue of contributory negligence. How the jury would have answered it, we don't know, and what percentage they could have attributed to Mr. Lee, if any. We don't know. But we do think, in line with Perez and other cases decided by this court, that at least that's enough evidence for us to have gotten the issue. And counsel also, I must say, is not being totally candid with the court when he makes the argument attempting to distinguish Mr. Justice Gonzalez's opinion in Keene, that the safety rule was not applicable to Mr. Lee. The safety rule, if they would just read it, says it applies to individuals working or in the spray mix, not room, area. And Mr. Lee admitted that he was in the spray mix area. In addition to that, he admitted that part of his duties were dumping sacks of silica, and the evidence shows that is a process that was done in the spray mix area. So this rule was applicable to Mr. Lee, and there's also evidence that there were rules of a similar nature applicable to other portions of this plant.
Mr. Counsel, are you aware of silicosis cases in other jurisdictions?
Your Honor, I've sat there embarrassed, or not embarrassed, but in not telling you that I did a Westlaw search on that point, and I did not come up with anything that I thought was a great moment. And I think the problem lies in the varying degrees in which other jurisdictions have or have not departed and gone to an amalgamated comparative fault system like we have in Duncan. There are some mass cases, however, in other kinds of products that we'll be more than happy to supply you. But
well, I can understand why the law from each jurisdiction might be different on the contributory negligence, and that
right.
might not be too helpful. But as to your argument on the second point of the case, which is that the uses of this product are so diverse that a warning is not a matter of law, it seems to me like surely some other appellate court is.
Well, again, Your Honor is pushing my argument into the fault area, and I am staying as far away from that as I
well,
possibly can.
Well, if I mischaracterized it, you at least know the argument I'm referring to.
Yes. We do cite to the court, I think, an intriguing opinion, the Chance case. We didn't discuss it very much because of time limitations. It's a very intriguing case to read because in footnotes, two footnotes, which are side by side, the page number I can't recall, the court discusses the concept of sole proximate cause and the varying impacts that has upon jury resolution of these very kinds of issues in warning cases when they are not presented with varying choices as to causation. It's the fault tree and the pruned fault tree, and I think that Your Honor will find that to be very instructive on the question that you're asking. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes the arguments for today. The foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will now please adjourn the court.
Please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. Y'all will please go to Texas. Now please.